This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 252 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me co-hosting this episode, our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Max. Good to be back again this week. Did a quick trip last week to St. Louis and managed to fly through some of the roughest weather in my entire life. It seemed like a storm went from Dallas all the way up to Chicago, and I was on Mr. Toad's wild ride getting back to Los Angeles.
Did you stay belted in the whole time?
Just about. Yeah, there was about 3 minutes where the captain said it was okay to get up, but the, 75, 80 other people that had to use the facilities, I just stayed seated.
Yeah, that's tough. Mm-hmm. That's very difficult. I've been in those shoes, but yeah, I'm sort of fanatic about keeping my seatbelt on, even if the air is calm, and as long as I'm in my seat, I'm buckled in. I just I don't know. Maybe I'm just too compulsive about it.
No, you and me both. I don't want to be scraped off the overhead bin.
Yeah, it gets messy. Mm-hmm. All right, it's you and me. All the other guys are off doing important things, including David Vanderhoof, still recovering. He's kind of slowly coming along. If you listen to our last episode, he sent in a little message, but we're eagerly anticipating David's return. And the other guys, too, as soon as they stop traveling to or doing things to, earn an income. Brian, I'm glad you're here this episode. Our guest this episode is Jennifer Rohde. Jennifer currently holds a commercial pilot certificate with single, multi-engine, and instrument ratings. She's a certified flight and ground instructor with single, multi-engine, and instrument privileges for flight instruction and advanced and instrument privileges for ground instruction. But Jennifer is also with the NTSB. She's been a field investigator since October 2003, and she's been the investigator in charge of a number of regional field and limited investigations during that time. Currently, Jennifer's a senior air safety investigator in the central region. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, the central region, how many regions does the FAA have? How many regions does the NTSB have?
I'll forgive you for that confusion just once. The NTSB has the Alaska region, the Western Pacific region, the Central region, and the Eastern region. So four regions in addition to our headquarters office in Washington, D.C.
I said FAA before. I think I have FAA on my brain all the time these days. The FAA also has regional offices in some ways aren't always fully controlled by the home office, it seems. Is the NTSB like that too? Are you guys fairly autonomous, or is there a lot of direction from the DC office?
We do receive direction from the DC office. We like to consider ourselves one large agency that can work in concert with one another, supporting headquarters and regional type investigations. But we can also work within our own regions and handle the accidents and the assignments that we receive within our region.
Okay. Now, I understand that you are a graduate of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. You have a Bachelor's of Science in Professional Aeronautics and a Master's of Science in Aeronautical sciences, but you also have a doctorate of philosophy in industrial and organizational psychology from Capella University. I imagine, some people think about those kinds of degrees, the latter one, the psychology degree, organizational psychology, and wonder about, what does that do for you in terms of a career? But I think understanding those kinds of concepts can be extremely helpful. Have you found that?
It is extremely beneficial. The IO psychology degree allows me to understand problems that people didn't know they had and help them to solve them in ways that they'll never understand. No, kidding aside.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we ever talk with Rob then?
I know. We need to arrange a session, I think.
No, it focuses on human factors. And so how do we train in the work environment? How do we interact in the work environment? The ergonomics of a work environment. So it's a very, very broad topic. And human factors is kind of the final frontier of accident investigation. So it's paramount that investigators have a good understanding of the human aspect of any sort of accident investigation.
Oh, sounds good. Well, we've got some news to talk about, some of the recent aviation news, and we're going to have a more focused conversation with Jennifer. We've also got an Australia desk report this week. Actually, Brian, we only got it a few minutes ago because Grant forgot to send it to us, so.
Oops.
Yeah. So, but they did. I was able to find Grant, and he sent it to us, so we've got that coming up. And we've also got a lot of really good listener feedback, some good topics, some meaty topics this week. We'll try to get to as much of that as we can. But first, we'll start again with the aviation news. Are you guys all ready?
All set.
Let's go.
Our first story is on the Airbus A400M crash. We have a couple of stories, one from BBC. Airbus A400M plane crash linked to software fault. What we see is that an analysis of the flight data recorders shows that there weren't any, what they call structural faults with the aircraft, but there was a, quote, serious final assembly quality problem, according to Airbus Group's chief of strategy. This relates, of course, to the Europrop TP400 turboprop engines, or rather the ECUs, the electronic control units. They say they were properly installed at final assembly. Brian, in reading these stories, I'm not sure if this was a hardware issue or a software issue or a human issue.
Well, yeah, I found this one fascinating because at first they said that it was a software issue, that the software wasn't loaded properly. And then a few days later, they came back and said that it was an assembly problem of the hardware, the engine itself, that it and the two together caused the crash. So it's, I don't know. I think as we get more information, we're finding out more and more, which I think ties in really nice with our guest here over the NTSB and how they would do a crash investigation and analysis versus the way our friends around the world do their investigations.
Yeah, Jennifer, there are some differences in approach. I guess it depends on, which agency, which country is conducting the investigation. Do you guys at the NTSB study and watch other investigations?
Absolutely. The NTSB is entitled to participate in foreign accident investigations through the ICAO Annex 13 as an accredited representative. If there's a U.S. interest from a manufacturing standpoint, an operator standpoint, and airline standpoint, then we're directly interested in knowing what caused that accident, what the issues are, so that we can correct them and be a part of the investigation and the prevention strategy. So absolutely. We also monitor other accident investigations to learn what their lessons are, understand what their processes and procedures are, learning vicariously through their accidents, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach, probably one that maybe seems obvious, but it makes additional work for you guys, I would imagine.
Oftentimes, it's something that is planned for and budgeted annually through our management program.
Do other countries, other investigations frequently draw on the expertise of the NTSB when there's no reason otherwise for the NTSB to be involved?
Yes. Oftentimes, other countries will come to the NTSB and ask us for assistance in leading an investigation. They may ask us for assistance in downloading different flight recorders that would have non-volatile memory on board. So they draw on the expertise of our engineering staff to help recover any data that might be recoverable. And sometimes they will rely or ask or request assistance from our metallurgy experts in understanding different failures.
Oh, yes.
Do they end up picking up the tab for that, or do we do that all complimentary to these other countries?
That's not something that I'm kept in the loop on, but my understanding is that's just something that we help out with.
Well, of course, this A400M crash is tragic in that we had a loss of life. From an Airbus perspective, it sounds like, Ryan, something that's going to end up being easily correctable. At least it's not a fundamental problem that's going to cause redesign. Maybe it's more of a procedural redesign than a hardware redesign.
Yeah, it certainly seems like manufacturing issues can be resolved. And if it was something with the loading of the software, even the execution of the software, that could be fixed as well.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our next story. This comes from geek.com. Pilots and air traffic controllers can finally stop talking and start texting. I thought that was kind of a misleading comment, Brian, didn't you?
Well, it...
misleading title, I should say. Yeah.
Yes, it's misleading, but I still wonder. And Jennifer, being the only pilot of the group here, I think the loss of situational awareness by the pilots because they're directly communicating with the tower or whoever by text, as opposed to broadcasting it and allowing other pilots to hear what's going on. I just see this as a terrible thing.
There's always unintended consequences when you make a change and start relying on technology. So it will definitely be interesting to watch this as it unfolds and see what strategies have been addressed and thought of by the engineers of this program and this concept to address exactly that.
Yeah, what this is about is an FAA program. It's called DataCom. The FAA's been testing this for 2 years now, and it's actually a piece of the next-gen process that lets pilots and air traffic control communicate instead of verbally communicate some things by text. The way this DataCom thing, or the example that's given, is that when an airplane is an airline is still on the ground, and there may be changes to the flight plan. And right now, what you have is a verbal exchange between the pilots and air traffic control, one communicating the change, the other repeating the change to make sure that it's communicated properly, then questions asked to make sure that there is an understanding. And then when they think there is, then they input the changes into the flight management system. Well, under this DataCom process, the communication is by text. It's on screen. The idea being that you can look at it, read it. If that's what you understand the change to be, the pilots can accept it, and that automatically loads it into the flight management system. That sounds like a good idea. That's sort of billed as a time saver, a way to ensure accuracy. I guess, Jennifer, there's probably been, I don't know if you can think of any off the top of your head, but there's probably been some incidents where communication, verbal communication, has been imperfect, and that's led to some kind of an incident.
There are a lot of incidents out there where the pilot misunderstood a clearance. A clearance wasn't given properly to the pilot or the flight crew. The one that sticks out in my head was Little Rock, Arkansas, several decades ago, where the information being relayed not to the pilots, but rather to the emergency responders, was not given correctly or in a timely manner, and it delayed them giving the necessary response to the airplane that had already crashed. So it changed the severity of the outcome of the accident, if that makes sense. But yes, lots of accidents out there related to communications.
Yeah,
Max, I just see this as a slippery slope, though. With the example that you gave, I absolutely see the benefit of getting this information in text format, and the speed and the accuracy is really good. But when that works, what else are they going to add to it? And as I started the comment, you know, how much of this negatively affects situational awareness, and how many accidents have been prevented because other pilots have heard the conversation between the tower and another aircraft?
It's an interesting thing to contemplate. And I mean, you wonder about the analogy with driving, right? You can't text in most places. You can't text while you drive because you lose that awareness. You certainly don't want pilots losing their awareness because they're focused on typing words into a little keypad. Nevertheless, this datacom system or process is rolling out this summer, starting with Houston Hobby and Houston International and Salt Lake City International Airports. And then the FAA hopes that the system should be operating at more than 50 air traffic control towers by 2016. So they're planning on rolling that out.
I found it interesting to note at the end of the article that most, if not all, U.S. airports will choose to adopt it. So it is this an optional program?
It kind of sounds that way, but I'm not positive. All right, next item. This comes from Ben Sanderlands in his plane talking blog at crikey.com. This is anti-Middle East airline claims by U.S. majors grows louder. What if they win? The basic idea here is that U.S. airlines have continue to fight the expansion by major Middle East carriers in the U.S. And in fact, there was a recent event at the National Press Club in D.C., and the CEOs of American Airlines, Delta Airlines, and United Continental Holdings, they got together, made a little a group appearance to voice their concerns. You don't usually see these three CEOs together with something to say. They were making a few points. Their points were that the Middle East carriers get government subsidies and U.S. carriers do not. They also said that U.S. carriers cannot hope to compete against rich foreign governments. Also that Emirates, Etihad, and Qatar Airways are quickly expanding before the U.S. government can block new flights. Ben has some interesting counterpoints to offer on this, I think.
Yeah, one of them certainly being Chapter 11 protection for U.S. carriers. Yeah, that's there, but is that really a subsidy?
Some argue that in effect it has the same effect. I mean, it lets you restructure your company, cut costs in ways that you couldn't if you weren't going through that process. And I'm thinking about labor contracts particularly. Others often cite that in saying that, well, that's another form of subsidy. You hear that a lot.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm on the fence leaning towards that's a bunch of hogwash. I just don't buy it. The same way that so many people have said Boeing is subsidized by the U.S. government because of the military contracts that they do. Therefore, they can't effectively compete against Airbus. And maybe it's me just being an American and U.S.-centric. I just don't buy that as a valid argument for this. So, I don't know.
My feeling is that almost all airlines across the world, I mean, get some sort of benefit some way, somehow, because of their situation, their relationship with their government or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the need as a corporate executive to try to minimize the intrusion of others into your market. But you know what? In the end, and I think this is where Ben is going with this topic in this article, is kind of like, stop crying and just compete. You know, yep. You want to compete in the press over arguments as to whether or not you're being subsidized or your competition is or not. Just focus on the service you're trying to provide and, you know, let the customers choose based on that. So I kind of tend to agree with Ben on that. I know it's kind of a bit of a political issue and some of our readers will take a different viewpoint.
I've been saying that for how long now? It's improve your product and I'll stop complaining. And again, you know, here's looking at you, United. Just improve the service and the butts will be in your seats.
Yes.
The one thing in the article I think that he talked about was that the 777, is it the ER or 777X, excuse me, is only ordered by non-US carriers. And didn't United actually trade some of their 787 orders for the 777X?
Yeah, I think so. And Ben is saying with the Middle East customers being such a huge component of that aircraft backlog, that you tick those guys off and they could just say, fine, well, I don't know if they could just say, but, you know, the possibility exists for them to potentially cancel those orders and switch over to the Airbus product. So, yeah, you got to be kind of careful with how far you take nationalism because, you know, there's those unintended consequences again.
I don't know, but with the backlog of the A350, they're certainly not going to get them soon unless if they pay a huge price for them, right, to cut the line with someone else. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, it's not so easy for, right. There's the issue of slot availability, purchase slot availability.
Cancellation terms.
And cancellation terms with the others. It can get very, very expensive to make changes like that. But it's a great article. I think Ben makes a lot of good points, and we'll have a link to this one in the show notes along with all the others that we talk about this episode. Moving on, we got in an article from Micah, our Maine man, sent in something from the Portland, Maine Press Herald. This is stubborn GE scientist pioneers breakthrough dream material. And what they're talking about here is ceramic matrix. GE has done a lot of really good work developing ceramic matrix material. The reason ceramic matrix material is good is that it is resistant to extremely high temperatures, and it's very strong, and it's very light. And when you're talking about jet engines, that's important stuff, particularly with the LeapX engine. GE's or actually CFM's a competitor to the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan because it uses a different strategy to achieve the reductions in fuel burn. It looks at higher pressures, higher temperatures, and takes kind of a different approach. And so a ceramic matrix is an example of a material that helps facilitate that kind of a strategy.
Yeah, two things with this article. One, I just really appreciated the fact that me being an idiot, I could read it and understand it. So that was wonderful. The other is, and Jennifer, this question goes to you. With new materials like this in an investigation, you have a bunch of, or at least a few, metallurgists, and now they have to look at this new material. It's almost like they would have to go back to school to understand the material in order to complete the investigation. Does this happen often? And is this, I don't know, a concern that I raise over new materials? Or how does that whole process work?
We're fortunate in that we have probably the smartest, brightest, most brilliant engineers working for us. And so when they're presented a task like this with a new material, a new technology, they do have a steep learning curve, but we have a phenomenal working relationship with other experts out there. We have phenomenal relationships with the FBI, who has a great lab. We have phenomenal relationships with the Department of Defense and the different laboratories, the different engineers, the different specialists within their work structure. And so our engineers can work with and collaborate with their engineers if they've seen similar failures, if they have experience with these materials, this technology. They can work together, get on the same page, understand the technology or the material, and then move forward to understanding whether or not the technology or the material played a role, causal or contributory, in the accident investigation. But there is a steep learning curve for our engineers as they come up to speed with that things are changing. But they do stay on the forefront and stay educated in addition to their regular work tasks.
It might be useful to mention for people who aren't familiar with the role that materials can play in an investigation, something like this, is that when you examine, let me put it in lay terms, in really strong lay terms if I can.
So I could understand it.
Yeah. It's kind of like you can tell a huge amount about what happened during a crash or an accident by examining the materials, the metals, or whatever the materials are, in terms of crack propagation. You can tell about the kinds of fractures and what were the forces involved. And I mean, Jennifer, you know this probably more than I do, but it's a huge part of the detective work to look at the broken metal and understand just exactly what were the physics or what were the dynamics of that were going on at the time of the crash.
Absolutely. And a lot of fun to look at the different sorts of failures within different materials, whether it be metal, whether it be wood, or in this case, ceramics. It will be very interesting to start to understand the failure modes of ceramics, aside from somebody throwing at you and it breaking against the wall.
Well, one thing I wanted to mention in this article, because I want to take issue with it, just make sure it's clear. There's a paragraph in this article, a couple of sentences. It says, so far, customers seem to be opting for the simpler, lighter LEAP. It is winning about 75% of the market for planes that size, and CFM has taken orders for 8,000 of them worth $100 billion. So, again, this is the issue of on the A320 class aircraft or family of aircraft, let's say. Customers have the option of choosing the LEAP engine or the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engine. When they say that the LEAP is winning about 75% of the market, partly that's because the competitor, the Boeing 737, is only offered with the LEAP engine. They have a exclusive arrangement with that. You don't have a choice of engine on that airplane. So if to use round numbers, if the Boeing 737 gets half the market and the A320 gets half the market for that size aircraft, right from the get-go, the LEAP engine has got 50% of it by definition. If the customers choose half LEAP, half geared turbofan on the A320s, then there's 25% for LEAP and 25% for Pratt & Whitney. So it's a little misleading to say that customers seem to be opting for the simpler, lighter LEAP. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. I have to defend my old employer.
And Max, that raises a question for me. What is the engine makeup? I know, like with the 777, there are a choice of three different engines for that. With the 757, there were, I believe, two. Maybe three.
Pratt and Rolls Royce.
What's the makeup? Is it usually 50-50, or does it depend on the airframe where one supplier would win out over the other?
It depends on the airframe to a large extent. So, for example, for the 787, originally all three of the major engine manufacturers were submitting proposals to Boeing. Pratt & Whitney dropped out deciding that the market was too small to support three. Pratt & Whitney also wanted to devote its energy to the narrow body market because it saw narrow bodies as representing a much larger component of the total than the wide bodies. Mm-hmm. Rolls-Royce, on the other hand, sort of walked away from the narrow body, in the end selling its share of International Aero engines to Pratt & Whitney. And lately, Rolls-Royce has been just strictly a wide body engine manufacturer, or essentially so. You know, now we see them talking about the future and maybe relinking up with Pratt & Whitney on the narrow body engines, the next generation. So it's kind of all combinations. It depends on the perceived size of the market. It depends on history. On the 737, Pratt & Whitney didn't aggressively develop engines for that airplane beyond the initial engine, thinking that it didn't represent a huge opportunity. Turned out they were wrong.
And
so that's why we see CFM International providing engines for that aircraft, and as I said before, in fact, having an exclusive on that. So different aircraft have different options or availability to the airlines. Who sells for what depends on all these other factors, history, the perceived size of the market, the investment. Sometimes you just can't afford to develop one more engine for one more aircraft. You've got to, you know, go with what you've got on the market
and focus on
that. So, yeah, there's a lot of dynamics there.
Are these LEAPs or the geared turbofan making their way into the military market as well, or are these designed really as commercial aircraft engines?
Right now, they're designed primarily as commercial aircraft engines. They could have applicability to maybe transport aircraft for the military, tankers and things like that, but so far, not so much. I think that will happen down the road. If David was here, he would be able to talk to us about how the U.S. military has focused on efficiency and fuel consumption and things like that in the past. And if they continue to do that, I think they're going to want to be interested in some of the newer technologies that offer, you know, 15%± reductions in fuel consumption.
Yeah, that's what was driving that question.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, speaking of the military, we have our next articles from Flight Global. Marine Corps F-35Bs depart USS Wasp after carrier tests. So the USS Wasp is an amphibious assault ship. It's kind of a smallish aircraft carrier, but they had six Marine Corps F-35Bs, the B model, that over a week and a half conducted some trials aboard the Wasp. They included 108 test sorties and even an F-135, an engine delivery from a V-22 Osprey. It's interesting how the length of time that it takes to introduce a new fighter, in this case, into the military, to be fully operational. It's just years and years and years. You know, we see all these tests just, you know, step by step. It's been a number of years since the first delivery. And, you know, we see that it just takes a long time for these things to all become operational. It's kind of amazing.
Well, if you rush into it and have a crash, that could potentially kill the program. So being conservative kind of makes sense to me.
I read this afternoon, actually, in another article, the F-35 coming up, I think this week, it will be its first time that it's participated in, not red flag, I think it's green flag, an event where they'll actually deploy weapons and things like that. And that hasn't happened before. So this is the first time that even that's going to be starting. So I guess they're making progress. It's been a bumpy road. Mm-hmm. But the F-35 keeps hanging in there.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting looking at the picture of the Wasp that it's a straight deck aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
I didn't think we had any of those any longer, but
oh,
I guess
sure.
We do.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. That's why we need David back to
I know.
Because if he's here, I just keep my mouth shut and
let David
so much
talk
more intelligent.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep.
Exactly.
Final news story. I know we've had kind of a lot this episode, but Malaysia Airlines. There's an article in Business Insider. Malaysia Airlines' new CEO is off to a good start, but doubts loom about the airline's future. So after the two unfortunate events involving Malaysia Airlines flights that I think we're all familiar with, it's been real hard times for Malaysia Airlines. Their new CEO, who is Christoph Mueller, he's an interesting guy. He was chief executive at Sabena, the Belgian airline, but he also restructured Ireland's Aer Lingus. He worked a revamp at Lufthansa. He's known as a micromanager. And I got to give the Malaysians credit for bringing this guy in to try to help salvage Malaysia Airlines. It's amazing how much damage to the reputation, to public confidence can occur when there are accidents like they've experienced, even with the shootdown. I mean, that was clearly not even their fault at all. But still, it goes to the public perception of the airline, and it's been a real mess.
Yeah, certainly not all press is good press, especially in that case.
Yeah.
Now, a 52-year-old German as a micromanager, I find that so hard to believe. sorry, I work for Germans right now, so.
We had a couple of listeners send in some emails. Steve sent in one. He sent an article from Aviation Week, talks about Malaysia Airlines looking at selling off some of their A380s, and there have been some different comments in the press about how many of their A380s they're planning on selling off. They're also looking at the labor agreements. Grant sent in some information and another link, a Reuters story. We'll put all these in the show notes. But Malaysia Airlines suffers from relatively high labor costs because of some of the union contracts. And so this new CEO has an opportunity, or is being given an opportunity, let's say, to address these and try to salvage the situation. It's kind of a Malaysian Chapter 11.
This will really show the commitment of the government to keep the airline running or not. Because if they could get rid of the bloat, if they could get rid of the corruption,
right,
if they want it to be truly a profitable airline, they have, I think, the right guy running the show to make that happen. If they block him along the way, I see it as though they really don't care. They want to maintain the status quo, and they should either go out of business or cost the government a tremendous amount of money to keep the bloated airline running. So
yes. Yep.
I really hope that they support him and allow him to do the job that he needs to do to get the airline back on its feet.
And it seems like they are supporting him at this point, kind of from what we can see, remotely through the press.
Yeah, but if there is corruption or side deals that were done or whatever, hanky panky that's going on, when that gets back to the government officials, it's like, hey, this guy wants to break our contract. Well, that's really where the rubber meets the road, and we'll see how serious they are.
All right. Well, again, we're speaking with Jennifer Rohde. She's the senior air safety investigator for the NTSB in the central region. Again, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, a couple of things that I noted from your bio, which says that you've been a survival factors group chairman and a witness group chairman. What are these groups that you've been chairman of?
In major investigations, you oftentimes have multiple groups looking at different aspects of the accident. So in any major investigation, you will have an operations group chairman, a structures group chairman, a power plants group chairman, a human performance group chairman, survival factors group chairman, if survival factors are considered to be a concern in the accident, a witness group chairman. If you have quite a few witnesses who experienced the accident and what they witnessed, what they observed, is important to collect and present during the investigative process separately. So depending on the complexity of the accident, the scope of the accident will depend on how many group chairmen that you have. But it's basically a person who is responsible for leading the party members and focusing on that aspect of the investigation and then reporting their findings back to the investigator in charge, the rest of the group, to understand how that contributes to the rest of the investigation.
Yeah, and what I was going to ask you was, is that investigator in charge the one that coordinates all of these groups? And I imagine
yes,
it
are.
Is.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The survival factors, what can you give an example of what that is? The witnesses I get, but the survival factors, I'm still a little unclear about that.
Absolutely. So survival factors would look into the survivability of an accident. They often look at the emergency response aspect of an accident. Sometimes you'll have people who survive an accident, but because they did not receive the aid that they needed as quickly as they needed it, it affected the severity of the outcome of the accident. Going back to the Little Rock, Arkansas accident years ago, survival factors was an aspect of that because the emergency response was not as timely as it could have been, rendering aid to those individuals. The Lubbock accident, where I was the survival factors group chairman, we found the same thing. The emergency response personnel could not respond as timely as they would have liked, in part because the gates that allowed them access to the airport were iced closed because of the ice storm at the time. So it's just something that we looked into and documented. We can also look at the seats that the passengers are sitting in, the seat belts. Did the seat belt fail? Did it work properly? Was it installed properly? So just depending on the particular accident will depend on what scope or what direction the survival factors group chairman work will go in.
Hmm. Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I think in my head, I guess I assumed that the focus was more on the accident itself, what caused it. But obviously the severity of the accident and how that could have been addressed or lessened in the future, that's just as important as what caused the accident itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I guess with the Asiana crash in San Francisco, you have people get out of the aircraft and then the emergency workers apparently run over one of them. So that definitely hits your statistics as well.
A lesson learned, something that we can take to the rest of the industry and affect the way that emergency response personnel are trained and prevent it from potentially happening again in the future.
Jennifer, maybe you can tell us a little bit about some of the interesting cases that you've been assigned to.
Absolutely. It's hard to say that there's one particular accident investigation that takes the cake over all of them. They're all different. Any accident investigation that I'm assigned that has a lesson to be learned, if you will, a takeaway aside from the pilot just made a mistake and lost control while they were landing. If there's something that we can take away and take back to the public so that we can prevent future accidents from occurring, those are always my favorite. Anytime that there's a new technology, those are always fun and interesting cases to be assigned. I did an accident about a year ago now, a little over a year ago, where an airplane flew into a wind turbine tower. And when I was first assigned the accident, we were told that it was a windmill. And upon arriving on scene, we learned that it was more than just a windmill, but rather a wind turbine. And how that investigation unfolded, there were a lot of different aspects for us to look into. The light that was on top of the wind turbine that was not functional at the time of the accident, the weather that was deteriorating at the time of the accident, the fact that it was nighttime, when the accident occurred, so reduced visibility. That was a very interesting accident, one of the first that we had done involving a wind turbine tower. So very, very interesting accident. I also just recently finished a special investigation report where we looked at agricultural accidents and more than just the cause of the accident, but maybe underlying themes across the accidents. And it was absolutely phenomenal to work with NAAA and the agricultural industry to better understand what it was that they do and to help them move towards reducing the number of the accidents that we see within the agricultural industry, understanding the demands on the pilots within their work environment. And when you think about what they do on a daily basis, flying at the altitude that they fly at, flying at the speeds that they fly at, the division of attention between the outside and the inside of the airplane, the different products that they're putting down on their target crops, and then having to address an emergency if you lose an engine or if the airplane is not performing like you would like the airplane to perform. So it was really interesting to learn more about that particular aspect of aviation, something that I did not know a lot about previously, but had some maybe incorrect understandings about that industry. So that one of the best parts of my job is just the learning curve and learning something new about technology or operations or a particular aspect of aviation.
Do you get assigned to certain types of incidents or accidents, or could be anything?
It could be anything. It could be a simple 152 accident where the pilot loses control on landing and it was because the crosswind component was exceeded for that particular airplane. I've been assigned large air carrier accidents where there was a fan disc failure, and I was the investigator in charge. I was responsible for bringing those different groups together that we discussed previously and leading the investigation. So it just depends on the time, the circumstance, when I'm on call, what resources available, and what happens.
And Jennifer, the NTSB is, as I refer to it, as responsible for planes, trains, and automobiles. Do you only handle aviation, or do you handle the other forms of transportation as well?
No, I am just an air safety investigator. I am not multimodal, but our, as you said, our agency is multimodal.
Yeah. What were you doing just immediately prior to coming to the NTSB?
I was flight instructing at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
Oh, and so wow. How did you make a move from that to the NTSB?
I started out, I was working on my master's degree, and I applied for a summer internship program. I had always looked towards the NTSB, very respected agency, some of the smartest, brightest individuals. And I thought, what a wonderful end of career goal to work for the NTSB. I love putting puzzles together. And so I thought, okay, this internship is a phenomenal opportunity to understand who they are, where they work, get some job experience, and to understand, is this what I want to do when I grow up? Is this what I want to focus on? And the internship led into a paid internship. I had the experience and the qualifications to be hired as a field regional investigator. And so it worked out well when I finished my master's degree. They had an opening that I could apply for and was subsequently hired for that position.
And did it turn out to be just exactly what you had thought the NTSB would be? Or were you surprised by a few things?
No, you know, it's been, for the most part, exactly what I expected. I think within any job, you're going to have expectations that are slightly different. You get you're on the outside looking in, if you will, and what you understand is what is portrayed to you from the media. And I think the great part is all of the cool things that they do at the NTSB, that we get to do at the NTSB, that it's more than just going out and kicking tin at an accident site.
Now, some of us have been to the NTSB training facility there in Northern Virginia. I know. Yeah. I had to slip that in. Brian hasn't been there. Nah, nah, nah.
Yeah.
Jennifer, did you get some training there?
Yes. Any investigator who has come in since they have opened up that training center attends one, if not multiple training courses there. We have a basic ASI 101 course that takes 2 weeks that all of our investigators attend when they start with the agency.
Jennifer, I was curious, being a woman at this job, and especially teaching at the Air Force Academy, where I'm assuming that it's an awful lot of the boys' club sort of thing, how difficult is it, or was it, being a woman instructing there? And your job at the NTSB, do you find being a woman to be challenging? Does it make your job easier? How's that worked out?
You know, a lot of people bring me coffee, and I've always wondered if that's why. But no, all joking aside, I have been extremely fortunate. Starting out flight instructing, I got to do a lot of deadhead legs for a 135 operator. I did pipeline patrol and photo recon. And I can't, they don't stick out in my head experiences where somebody degraded me or did not give me equal opportunity because of my gender. I have not had that battle or had any difficulties like some of my female counterparts, not necessarily at the NTSB, but within aviation in general. So I've been very fortunate in that aspect that my gender does not play a role in how hard or how easy it is to do my job. It's all based on motivation and dedication to the job and what I'm willing to do and make happen. From the woman aspect, I have a child. My supervisors have been extremely supportive of allowing me to have that aspect, just like they would any of my male counterparts who have children. And so I can't say that being a woman is more difficult in my job. I certainly stick out when you're working in a field where men hold the majority of the roles or the positions. You're on an accident site. You're the investigator in charge. People come up and say, "You must be Jennifer." So my joke is, "What gave me away?" And I'm the only woman on scene. So, you know, it's something to laugh about, but it has never been an obstacle or an issue for me. And I recognize that. For that, I'm very grateful and very fortunate have not had to struggle with that.
Yeah. Do most people coming into the NTSB have kind of a significant history in aviation or these other modes of transportation? I'm thinking about there probably aren't a lot of kids fresh out of college, let's say, who start off in the NTSB as their first job. Is that a fair assessment?
For the most part, yes. Yeah. Especially for the engineering positions, the go team investigators who their sole focus, what they specialize in within the agency are those specific aspects of a major investigation. By and large, those individuals are not fresh out of college. They have industry experience in their particular field of expertise. So we do hire individuals fresh out of college. But again, a lot of times we're seeing that they have previous military experience. Mm. They've been a flight instructor that has gone back to school. They've been an airline captain that has gone back to school. So we do have young employees, new hires who come in, but we do have requirements for flight experience, for a 4-year degree, and then experience within a specialization per se, unless you come in through a cooperative education program. So we're looking for industry experience before you're hired.
Before the show, we were talking about transparency, and it's something that we've talked about with others from the NTSB. I think when we talked with Robert Sumwalt, we talked about this a little bit, but transparency is something that's sort of a hallmark of the NTSB. And partly due to the sort of the independent nature of the organization.
Absolutely. We're an independent federal agency. And I like to explain that to anybody who's willing to listen. Anytime I go out and give a presentation, I start out with, we are an independent federal agency. We do not report to the Department of Transportation, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Defense. We report directly to the President of the United States and Congress. And that allows us to conduct a transparent investigation. We don't have a dog in the fight. We're not the ones writing the regulations. We're not the ones designing the aircraft. We're not the ones testing the aircraft, the buses, the trains. All we want to do is understand what caused that accident, prevent it from happening again in the future, and present those facts to the public so that everybody can learn from it. And so we don't have a dog in the fight. We don't have anything to hide. So it allows us to be transparent. We don't have anything to lose, if you will. So extremely, extremely important, and something that needs to maintain intact so that we can continue to do the phenomenal job that we do. And I am biased in that aspect. I do believe the NTSB does a phenomenal job at what they do.
Oh, I think so too. I think we all do.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's one of the things I wanted to say is I hope that you guys stay independent forever. And hopefully no one will ever think about, I might go back on privatizing you guys, but certainly having you report into another governmental agency, I think will be tragic.
Yes, we once reported to the CAA, the Civil Aviation Authority, and as was learned at that point 45 plus years ago, it didn't allow us to truly examine an aviation accident because the Federal Aviation Administration now, the Department of Transportation, they're just as much a part of some accident sequences as the pilot, as the manufacturer of the airframe, as the manufacturer of the engine, as the person who maintains the airport. So they need to be under scrutiny and under investigation just as much as any other aspect. And when you report to them, you do not have that freedom to do your job correctly. Mm-hmm.
The NTSB is active in social media, things like that, and we see in YouTube a number of videos, reports, investigations on YouTube. If you just go to YouTube and search for NTSB, all kinds of stuff comes up.
Absolutely. I think we could have a Google war with you guys at this point, and we might be a little bit ahead.
Yeah, you might. You're right.
Absolutely. We have several videos that are out there right now. Some of the videos are just raw live feed from press interviews that are given during the first stages of an accident investigation. And we also have some educational material, not just for aviation, but for all modes of transportation, where we talk about a specific safety topic. For example, there's a multimodal one out there that talks about the use of electronic devices and how that can provide a distraction for you no matter what type of vehicle you're operating, whether it be a train, an airplane, or a car. And then since we're on an airplane show this evening, we have a lot of aviation-specific safety alert topics. We talk about decision-making. We talk about maintenance that's performed on airplanes. And there's one that that talks about the decision-making a pilot has to go through when they have a known mechanical anomaly and being aware and cognitive and steps that they can take to avoid being involved in the repeat-type accidents that we see on a regular basis where pilots are operating airplanes with known mechanical anomalies and it results in an accident. So taking those combined lessons learned from the smaller accidents that don't get the press and the media attention, combining them and then providing them in a short, sweet instructional format to say, hey, this accident happened. This is what we learned, and these are the steps that you as a pilot, you as an operator, you as a mechanic can take to avoid being involved in future similar accidents.
Jennifer, one of the things that we brought up when Robert Sumwalt was on the show, we talked about the separation between, or the focus difference between what the NTSB does versus your counterparts around the globe. And it seems like the NTSB is really in, their focus is to find the root cause and prevent it from happening again, whereas it seems like other agencies are more concerned about placing blame.
I wouldn't say that it's so much as the agency itself focusing on placing blame. I would look closer to the culture and the regulatory structure within that country. Within the United States, the way our rules and regulations are written, the NTSB is given primacy in an investigation. So we are allowed to look at the facts, the circumstances, the conditions that happened in an aviation accident before the lawyers get involved and the insurance adjusters get involved and are allowed access to that information. And it's not always the same in other countries. Napoleonic Code is something that comes up in discussion on a regular basis. They have a different culture and they have a different regulatory foundation or structure where the legal aspect of an investigation takes primacy over the causal or the preventive aspect. So we have our counterparts in other countries. Their focus is prevention, but because of the way their structure is, it takes a different lead or a different precedence, if you will.
Jennifer, we've had Bill English on a few times in the past.
Oh, great guy.
He's been a great... Well, I was going to... Have you ever been in on an investigation with him?
I have not worked an investigation with him, but we did run a 5K together last year at Oshkosh.
You did?
Wow. We did.
is he as mean and grumpy as everyone says?
Oh, he just a very grumpy teddy bear with teeth. I like to. No, he's a phenomenal guy.
Yeah, I'm
and
just kidding.
Very knowledgeable and probably our up and coming star with regards to UAVs,
yes.
UAS, and how that's going to come in and combine and integrate within the aviation structure. So phenomenal
guy. Yes, that's a very interesting topic. Yeah, we had him talk to us on the UAV Digest, a different podcast on that very topic. And it's very interesting to see how the NTSB approaches a whole new technology like UAVs present. So yeah, fascinating.
Absolutely.
Well, Jennifer, we want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's always a delight to have folks from the NTSB. We can't have this conversation without using that word transparency. And I know it gets overused sometimes, but when it comes to the NTSB, the things that I think of first are both the quality of the investigation and the transparency, the ability of the NTSB to communicate not only to the directly interested parties, but also to the public at large. And I think that's amazing and very laudable. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your kind words. It's been a privilege to be here.
Jennifer, how can people learn more about the NTSB and the activities that you're involved in?
They can go to our website, www.ntsb.gov. They can go to YouTube and Google NTSB and watch our phenomenal videos that we have out there on safety. Or if they have a question for me, I'm more than happy to answer any emails that I can or pass them along to more appropriate individuals. And they can reach me at jennifer.rodi@ntsb.gov.
And Rodi is R-O-D-I.
Correct.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 1st of June, 2015.
Well, g'day, folks. Welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 352 on the 1st of June. And, Grant, of course, as everybody knows on this side of the world, that's the first day of winter. It's cold already.
Yeah, it was rather cold today.
It was rather brisk. Well, you know, Grant, we say this every year, don't we? It was cold by our standards. Now, nobody from the US where it actually gets really, really cold, and none of you Europeans either, send in and tell us that we don't know what we're talking about. Hey, great density altitude here today. That's all I'm saying. Grant, let's talk all things airlines. And, well, Grant, surprise, surprise, the airlines are not happy.
Yeah, that's right, mate. That's right. It's because our glorious leaders are contemplating reducing restrictions on domestic flying of passengers for international airlines. It's basically a reduction, a loosening, you might say, of the cabotage restrictions. Many are saying that you reduce cabotage, you increase sabotage. Ba-dum-tsh. But basically what's happening is they're considering a proposal to allow foreign airlines to pick up passengers and fly them between destinations north of the Tropic of Capricorn. Tropic of Capricorn being, of course, the line which defines where the tropics start when you're going from south to north. Tropic of Cancer is the one in the northern hemisphere. So technically you could fly into Darwin from overseas on an airline. They could pick up some Australian passengers in Darwin and fly them to Townsville or even across to Broome or things like that. So basically, it's not going to allow somebody to come in and stop in Darwin and then fly on to Sydney, having picked up Darwinians to take to Sydney. It's mostly just for flights in the tropics. But still, it's got the hackles up on a lot of folks. The airlines and the unions are all joining in saying this is a bad thing.
And I don't know that's particularly bad criticism there either, Grant, because, you know, as is pointed out in this article that we'll put a link to in the show notes by our good friend Steve Creedy, Australian domestic carriers have just come out from a rather, as he puts it, a bruising capacity war, which forced down fares and plunged them into deep, deep losses. Now, you know, that's sort of moderated a bit now, but bringing in more competition from foreign airlines who, you know, have backing from their governments, a lot of them do anyway, I don't know that that's a really good move for them, and wouldn't be, you know, the flow and effects for jobs I don't think would be particularly positive either. But the interesting thing is, Grant, well, everything north of the Tropic of Capricorn in this country, well, there's not that many people in the grand scheme of things. There's not that much population north. Most of Australia's big population centres are way south of the Tropic of Capricorn. So really, what's the point?
Well, it's mostly for the foreign travellers, I guess, and for there is a bit of a movement between, you know, Darwin and Townsville and Broome and Port Douglas. But, you know, it's there's a lot of people waving the flags of, yeah, it's going to increase competition. It'll probably drop prices a little, but then it's also going to turn around and lead to some of the domestic airlines going, well, stuff it, we're not going to fly those routes anymore because it's just not effective for us. And you're also getting the cards raised of, well, we've got some of these foreign airlines that they're really just not that safe, is what people are saying. They don't have to comply to Australian business regulations and to Australian safety regulations. So meanwhile, the domestic operations all have to comply to the extremely expensive regulatory compliance that is flying in Australia. And they also have to comply with workplace rules and the taxes that the other airlines don't have to worry about.
Let's say they brought this in, and let's say theoretically, as John Borghetti from Virgin is suggesting here, that Australia would make these routes unviable for our own domestic carriers. Okay, let's say they stop operating up in that area. Well, that's not going to mean low prices are going to hang around for a long time, because if that competition disappears, we can guarantee that fares will go straight back up again. And, you know, instead of paying those high fares with an Australian flag carrier, you might be paying it to an AirAsia X or whoever.
Yeah, it's really rare that you see the pilots union, the maintenance work union, the airlines, and a whole lot of other groups all saying the same thing, which is, this is bad.
Yeah, I tell you what, Grant, in all the years we've been doing this segment, this might be the first time ever that we've reported that they're all in furious agreement with each other. I don't think this has ever happened before.
It could be a bit of a first, mate.
Well, Grant, let's move on from airlines and let's talk exciting things like the Red Bull Air Race. Aussie Matt Hall back on the podium again.
That's right, mate. I was staying up late last night to watch it. I stayed up late Saturday night to watch the qualifying, and that was really cool. It was pretty good flying going on. And then last night, I thought Matt was out. I thought he had been pipped out by Nigel Lamb, but lo and behold, he wound up as the fastest loser. I'm not sure I really like that phrase, but anyhow.
Yes, the lucky loser, let's say. Into the round of eight he went, Grant. And then he comes up against Paul Bonhomme of the UK. Now, anyone who tries to race up against Bonhomme is going to have their work cut out for them. The guy is a superb pilot and very, very hard to beat.
He certainly is, mate. But I tell you what, Matt flew first and he did the fastest run through the course of anyone in the whole weekend. absolutely blistering. It was certainly the day's fastest, and I think it was the fastest for the whole weekend, and he certainly put the pressure on Bonhomme.
And it certainly showed. In fact, it really forced him to fly dangerously. And let's have a listen to the race callers here, Nick Fellows and air show legend Mike Mangold, call the action.
Nice. He didn't roll early. He's up in the vertical. A nice hard turn. He's up in the time as well. Into chicane for the last time. 0.39. Bonhomme raising his game. Exactly where he needs it. It's an overg, a DNF for Paul Bonhomme. His race is over.
Yes, the maximum G limit. In fact, one of the rules they brought in for the relaunch of the series last year was that pilots are not allowed to exceed 10 Gs in a turn. You know, in previous series, sometimes they'd go 11, and even I've even seen as high as 12 just briefly. Obviously, that's not safe. So anyone who goes over 10 Gs in a turn is straight away disqualified. And that's what happened to Paul Bonhomme there. So Paul Bonhomme is a superb pilot and a very, very smooth flyer. But the turn that he pulled there on that gate, if you see it in the replays that you'll see in the Red Bull Air Race coverage coming up later in the week, he really did have to push it there. And well, good on Matt Hall. He really forced him into a position where he had to do that, and it paid off for him.
That's right, mate. And then he made it through to the final four, and the round of four, he wound up coming third. Mate, I tell you, I thought it was all over when he got pipped out by Nigel, and he came back in, and it was just amazing. Had me on the edge of my seat pretty much the whole night. Absolutely amazing.
The race in the end was won by Austrian champion Hannes Arch. Martin Schonka came second, and I guess the margin there was 0.071 of a second between the three, so very, very tight. Let's have a listen to see what Matt Hall had to say after the race.
It didn't start the way I hoped with the round of 14, having to just scratch through as the fastest loser, but I was really proud of myself in the round of eight. Once again, I think any of us could have won that race today, and I've just been pipped again by a mere tenths of seconds. So it's good to be gathering points, and it's good for a third podium. I keep pushing for that win.
He certainly does keep, it's really, really close now. But interestingly, with Bonhomme not scoring, major points in that round, and Matt Hall getting another podium, they're both now equal top of the ladder in the overall stakes, both on 25 points each. Well, Matt Hall is a former Royal Australian Air Force pilot, as we've mentioned many, many times, which lets us segue quite neatly to news about the Royal Australian Air Force. Grant, a couple of quick stories here about some of their heavier metal.
The Royal Australian Air Force's E7A Wedgetail Airborne Early Warning and Control Platform, aka the toaster, has completed its final operational capability. It's now fully up and ready to go. The whole chain of logistics, training, support, everything, it's all fully operational. And a big chunk of that was proving itself on operations in Iraq as part of Operation Okra.
Now, certainly a good way to get those aircraft bedded in. Of course, the six Wedgetail aircraft that we have in the fleet here, they've been flying around the skies for quite a number of years now. Obviously, a lot of newer technology there to prove, and it's certainly taken a long time to do it, but that's just the way of things when it comes to this sort of cutting-edge technology. So glad to see that those aircraft are coming in. And I tell you what, Grant, it's an exciting time to be in the Royal Australian Air Force. I've said this quite a few times lately, but the number of new aircraft that are coming into our fleet now is fantastic. And another story we see here in australianaviation.com.au talks about one of our latest acquisitions, a new C-17 rolling out of the paint shop there at the Long Beach plant over there in California. So, the first of an additional two of those aircraft coming across.
That's right, mate. We mentioned about them a while back, and they've finally had all the paperwork done and obviously just about to come over, because lo and behold, there's that tail with the stallion on it, and looking forward to seeing how they're going to squeeze all of these into the space that they've got. But I guess with some in maintenance and some deployed overseas and others working around Australia, they should be able to park them in many locations.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. I tell you what, Grant, here with wintertime, I think I can almost see the allure of flying hot air balloons. It must be nice and toasty warm up there, mate.
Oh, once the burners kick in, you definitely do warm up, but it's during the cold inflation with the fan blowing cold air past you, if you're holding the mouth of the balloon open in the middle of winter, just ask a few friends that I've had doing that for me.
Okay, well, I'm still not going flying with you in that case. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran. Up, up and away, man.
Cheers, folks.
Thanks, guys. Jennifer, have you ever been to any air races, Red Bull or Reno or anything like that?
I have not. It's on my bucket list.
Yeah, so. It's on my bucket list too. I really want to see this. Yeah, you watch the video from the Red Bull Air races. It's just, or even from Reno. And it's just, I can't believe the G-forces these guys are talking about. 10, 11? Yes,
phenomenal.
Just amazing.
Yeah, Max, I was planning on getting to Japan to watch Matt Hall this year, and unfortunately work got in the way of my social life and I wasn't able to go.
You were going to take a social flight to Japan?
Don't you hate it when that happens?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you been to Japan?
Yeah, I used to go there every 6 weeks and then spend a year living in Tokyo.
Oh, wow. Really? Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Tokyo. Maybe not quite as much as you, but Narita was an airport that I waited in for many hours over the years.
Yeah, and now they have the flights into Hanada.
Haneda.
Yeah, that would have been
or
nice
Hanada
to have.
If you're Japanese.
Oh, my Japanese never got better. Oh. It started off terrible and went downhill from there. So
it's not too tough. Well, to speak, of course, you can't learn to read it or write it. But the speaking is not too bad. But all right. Anyway, back to aviation. Well, we have some shout outs. First of all, we'd like to thank Hendrik from Hamburg, Germany. He made a donation to us. We mentioned previously that we have a donation button, a PayPal donation button on airplanegeeks.com if you'd like to support us financially. And so Hendrik took advantage of that, and we want to thank him very much for that.
And we'd also like to thank John Chargo for making a donation as well to support us in our crazy venture here.
Very good. Much appreciated. Also wanted to mention the Passenger Choice Awards. We're in the period where they're collecting data. This was created by by APEX, the Airline Passenger Experience Association. And this is where you go into this website, which is passengerchoiceawards.com, and you can rate your recent in-flight experiences. In fact, if you've had a lot of flights, you can go in multiple times. The feedback, besides being reported to everyone, also really goes directly to the airlines, and they have over the years become very well. They anticipate this with a lot of excitement because of the feedback that it gives. The period is still open through June 30th, 2015. Winners announced at the APEX 2015 Expo, which is in Portland, Oregon this year, September 28th through October 1st. We want to talk about the Solar Impulse, the Solar Impulse 2, actually, pretty briefly. This aircraft, of course, is making an around-the-world solar-powered flight. The website is solarimpulse.com. You can follow them along there. They've been holed up in China for kind of a long time. The big leg coming up is to Hawaii, and there's been some weather in the way. They need five or so consecutive days and nights for this flight. They started from Nanjing the other day, but the weather stopped cooperating again. So I understand that they're in Nagoya, Japan, speaking of Japan, and waiting for the weather again. But we'll have some links to that in the show notes. You can follow that along.
So, Max, do you know, are they still planning on doing 5 days, or from Nagoya, are they just going to do however many days it takes to get to Hawaii?
Well, I guess it'll be however many days it takes, but the plan is to go nonstop all the way to Hawaii, which they think will take about 5 days, I guess. And of course, that's quite a stint because they don't make stops.
That'll definitely be a proof point for them, won't it?
Yeah, I don't know how you stay awake for that long, but it's an exciting thing. They're going to go to Hawaii. And then from there to the United States, hopefully to Phoenix, and they have a stop in New York. So especially if you're on the route and may get to see this, you might want to check that out. But again, the site is solarimpulse.com. A little bit of listener mail. We had a question from Renee. He was asking us about episode 348 that we had with Harold Livingston. So here's Renee's question.
Hi, Geek. This is Rene from Germany. I refer to this episode with Harold, and I'd like to ask a question. If there was any participation of Germans during that Israelian war, I wonder if that could happen. So thank you, sir.
So thanks for the question, Rene. We reached out to Harold Livingston, and he wrote back and said that he's not aware of any indigenous Germans that were in that air effort. But we want to thank Rene for the question and Harold for giving us that answer. That's been a great popular episode, 348. That's where we talked with Harold about the movie Above and Beyond. So you can find that at airplanegeeks.com/348. On the airline hacking question, boy, I think this is a debate that just kind of goes on and on and on. We've had a lot of emails between us and our friends in Australia and maybe some others about whether this is possible or not. Brian, I don't know how many emails have flown around on that, but
lots.
But we did hear
and I must say I helped an awful lot in the contribution to the overflow of everyone's inbox for that.
Oh, but that's quite all right. But we also heard from a couple of listeners. Jim wrote us on this topic, and also Rob. And not our Rob, a different Rob. And we have a couple of articles in there. There's one from Spiegel or Der Spiegel from Germany, cyber attack warning, could hackers bring down a plane? We got that from Jim. He said you might be interested in the German take on hacking. One thing about that article that's interesting is it talks about a guy, a Spaniard, who told EASA, the European Aviation Safety Agency, that he bought, and this was a couple of years ago, but he bought some original equipment parts on eBay, and he was able to simulate the data exchange between the jet and the ATC and identified possible back doors. Rob wrote us. He said he put the question to a friend who's an A380 captain asking if this hacking is possible, and he replied that he thinks it's a high possibility, the captain did. Part of what he said is the very fact that flight passengers could easily make the switch between watching television and getting a real-time map showing their current coordinates and trajectory, data that only the plane's internal system could provide, already proves that there is a data link between flight control and the IFE. So it's, you know.
I took exception to that. Go on.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say, there's so many ways to get that information that is not conclusive proof that the two systems are linked together. Yeah. I definitely took exception to that. And again, I'm not saying that it's not possible that the two systems are together. I just think that that example isn't valid.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. We don't really know. Jennifer, does the NTSB follow this issue along?
I think we're paying attention to the extent that there's the possibility if this individual truly did hack into the system that it could result in an incident, an accident, a loss of control, which we would want to better understand and investigate. But it's not something that we are actively involved in right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine.
And so the question that I put to our Rob, being the pilot of us, is if someone is able to successfully hack into the system and take control of the aircraft, is it possible for the pilot to override those commands? Or is it possible, especially with the fly-by-wire systems, where the computer doesn't know where the control's coming from, if it's coming from the cockpit or outside the cockpit?
Yeah.
And there was just no answer to that, or not yet. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
But
I
don't know. This air gap becomes really important. And the fact that Boeing and Airbus hasn't come out to say absolutely an air gap exists, yeah, has me concerned.
Yeah. It could greatly help the conversation if there were statements to that effect from the airframers. Maybe they exist. Maybe an air gap exists. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe they just don't really want to comment on it and hope the whole thing will just sort of, you know, blow away, dry up and blow
away. That ain't happening.
But it doesn't really seem to, because it captures the imagination and it makes for, you know, great headlines that get lots of clicks. So, you know, that's not going to die. And I'm sure we'll be talking about it more. I think I made the comment that I don't really envision, you know, somebody sitting in coach suddenly flying the airplane, but the vulnerability may be more along the lines of someone who somewhere in the process injects some code that causes other issues down the line. And it may not be someone flying the airplane. It may be something that gives a false indicator to the pilots and causes them to take some kind of action that results in a serious incident. But yeah, who knows? It's all just speculation.
Or maybe even it doesn't have to happen that day.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And that becomes even more scary.
Right. Exactly. So,
now I'm promoting fear.
I would be interested in somebody hacking in and getting me a free TV during one of those flights.
Yeah. or an upgrade to first class.
There you go. There you go.
That's what I want to see.
That's right. Use these hacking skills for good, not evil.
That's right. That's right. Let's think positive.
Well done.
We got an email from Charlie Branch. He sent us a link to a interview with Bert Rutan, and this goes along with the conversation we were having in episode 350 on Bert Rutan and what he's doing. This website, flighttest.com, has an episode where they spoke with Bert for an extended period of time, and he's not only talking about the aircraft that he's developing that we talked about, but he's also helping to launch RutanRC.com, which is something that's developing, well, RC models of Bert's designs, another Kickstarter campaign. But it's episode 74 of the Flight Test Podcast. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. That is very interesting. Recommend that you listen to that.
Great. Just another way for me to give money and have time taken out of my day. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. 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 All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. This has been episode 352. Find us at airplanegeeks.com, or you can go straight to the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/352. We want to thank our guest, Jennifer Rohde, Senior Air Safety Investigator in the Central Region of the NTSB. Again, Jennifer, thank you so much for the great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have to have you back.
That would be awesome.
I think we should have you back.
Hey, I was going to say, I know the guy that does the scheduling around here, so
we might
be able to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, this has been fun. I was quite nervous coming into this, but this has been so much fun.
Oh, it's always fun. Yeah. It's nothing to be nervous about. Your husband, is he also in aviation?
He is not. He is right now. He is a stay-at-home dad. He takes care of our son, but he dabbles when he has a free moment in mechanical engineering. He's a mechanical engineer, bus and train design, powertrain, and he is currently restoring motor cars or maintenance away vehicles for the Greeley Freight Station Museum and the Cheyenne Depot Museum here where we live. So he's an accomplished machinist and design engineer. So
what kind of motor
very,
cars?
Very, very talented. They're the maintenance away vehicles that you saw in the 40s and the 50s that they used for track maintenance on the railroads.
Oh, yes. Oh, interesting.
They call them speeders or maintenance of way vehicles or rail cars. So they have a couple of different names. We own four of them, and we operate them with the NARCOA, or the National Rail Car Operators Association.
Are those the things you pump up and, you know, you pump manually?
Those are hand cars. Those are powered by human effort, and the ones that we own are actually powered by gas engines. We have a two cycle motor car. So it's similar to your lawnmower type engine or weed whacker type engine. And then we have a full four piston engine that operates one of our larger motor cars.
Wow.
So
fascinating.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
All right. You can find us not only at airplanegeeks.com, but on Twitter. Just look for Airplane Geeks. We're also on Facebook, Google+, Stitcher.com, and TuneIn Radio. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Brian, if folks decide they have some reason to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Well, the best reason for someone to get in touch with me would be A, they work for Boeing or Airbus or know someone that wants to be on the show so they could get in touch with me so I could get them scheduled. Another great reason for people to get a hold of me would be to make a donation. So always looking for that. And they could do that by going or by sending me an email at brian@airplanegeeks.com.
All right. Very good. And again, we're looking forward to our visit to the National Air and Space Museum at the Stephen Uvar-Hazy Center next to Dulles. That's June 20th. That's Saturday before Father's Day. If you're going to be in the area and you can stop by for this event, which is really an amazing event, you'll want to check that out. But if you're going to go, make sure to stop by and say hello to the Airplane Geeks. All right. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. And we invite you to join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night.
Say bye, Jennifer.
Good night.
I thought she was going to say goodbye, Jennifer.
I did too.
I should have. Darn it. Can we retake?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Say goodbye, Jennifer.
Goodbye, Jennifer.